The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Roots of Polish Jewry, The Life and Times of Rabbi Yaakov Polak, is dedicated to the memory in Le'ilu Nishmos, Rabbi Avraham ben Harav Mordechai, the Toba Bas Harav Yehuda, Mr. and Mrs. Abram and Toba Garden. 15th century Germany witnessed not only widespread massacres and terrible persecutions, but also the increased dispersion of its Jewry. From the middle of that century, after the mass murders instigated by the Franciscan monk Saint John of Capistrano and his ilk, Germany became all the more an inhospitable place for its Jews. In 1462, after the Jews were expelled from Mainz, Rabbi Yehuda Mintz, a prestigious disciple of Yaakov Weil and Rousseau Isserlein, left Germany and settled in Padua, Italy, joining the other scholars and refugees who settled in Italy. At the same time, his cousin, Rav Moshe Mintz, left Germany and settled in Posen, Poland. He was one of the first Gedolim, great men of stature, who settled in that country. In the year 1474, following his release from imprisonment on false charges of murdering a Christian child, the aged Rav Yisrael Bruna, another illustrious disciple of Yaakov Weil and Rousseau Isserlein, left his home of Regensburg, Germany, and settled in Prague. As time went on, things in Germany only became worse. In the year 1475, following the footsteps of his revered master, St. John of Capistrano, the Franciscan monk Bernardino di Feltre, a masterful orator, preached against the Jews in the city of Trent, where coincidentally, soon afterwards, the Jews of the city were accused of killing a little boy of 28 months by the name of Simon. The poor Jews of Trent were tortured and finally burnt at the stake. Soon afterwards, the Jews of the famed community of Regensburg were imprisoned on false charges and their entire wealth plundered. They were only released after some 5 years. At the same time, the Jews of Swabia in southwest Germany were all expelled. The word Schwab comes from Swabia. But as Germany's Jewish population was shrinking, other Jewish centers arose that served as a refuge for Germany's survivors. The Jews of Germany brought with them to their new home their language, Yiddish, and their love and devotion to Torah. They also brought with them another invaluable treasure. David HaMelech, King David, wrote in Tehillim, Psalms chapter 119, verse 92, Lulei seiros hoshashuai ozovati b'oni. Had it not been for your Torah, my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. As the Medrash points out, the delight and peace of mind that Torah study affords was the source of strength throughout the ages for Jews and enabled them to endure their afflictions. But even as the study of Torah as a whole provides joy and stability, there's one area of Torah in particular that has the power to erase away the common worries of life. That is pilpul. The word pilpul in Hebrew actually means pepper. As it relates to Torah, it refers to the sharp, pepper-like, and brilliant analysis of Torah, asking and resolving questions and casting new and penetrating light on old time-worn topics. Pilpul is so important that according to the Gemara and Shabbos, in 31a, Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, one of the questions that a departed person is asked by the heavenly tribunal is, Pilpalto b'chochma, have you engaged in the give and take, the questions and answers, and mind-opening analysis of pilpul? Through the ages, though, pilpul has taken on different faces. In the 15th century in Germany, the pilpul that was very much a core part of the curriculum of the yeshivas appears to become much more speculative and less rigorous than in previous generations. It would seem, though, that pupil, in its unrestrained and speculative form, provided much-needed stimulation for the Jewish people, who found themselves in an increasingly hostile world. When the Jews of Germany moved to Poland, this German form of pupil soon became an anchor and mainstay of Jewish life. In fact, it gained a life of its own as the pupil in Poland reached new conjectural heights, well beyond the original German model. There were many great scholars, however, had serious misgivings of this new metamorphosis of pupil. That story and how Poland developed into a major center of Torah scholarship is the subject of tonight's lecture. Probably the best place to begin understanding the nature of the change of Torah study during the 15th century is to read together the words of one of its strongest critics. The Sefer Orchas Tzadikim, a classic work on Jewish morals and ethics, was composed by an anonymous author who, as scholars have pointed out, was in all probability raised in France and moved to Italy in the 15th century. This is what he had to say regarding the pupil that was prevalent in his time. It's on page 1. The early generations gave their lives for the study of the Torah. They knew without great analysis, because they didn't probe that much, but they still knew the entire Talmud with commentary and Tosafos. We say the Tosafos are the analytical commentary, which is printed on the sides of the Talmud, written by the German scholars of the 12th and 13th centuries. Afterwards, due to our great sins, many were the calamities that befell us, and as a result, the yeshivas diminished. The later commentaries of Tosfos were a burden for them, which they could not bear. Other great scholars came and condensed these later Tosfos, each scholar according to his wisdom, in order to make the study of Talmud easier for the people of that generation. But even in those days, they were expert in the entire Talmud, and they knew the commandments based upon their direct knowledge of the Talmud. Their essential emphasis was on reviewing the material in order to be able to effectively recall all of it. In this generation, however, the Torah has become forgotten. This is because the scholars think that they can do it as the earlier generations and put great emphasis on pupil, this is dialectic analysis and argument. They are not, however, in any way comparable to the scholars of France, whose minds and hearts were open as wide as the entrance of the hallway of the sanctuary, and the study of Torah was their sole occupation. The scholars of France would figuratively kill themselves day and night in order to study Torah. That is why they were able to grasp and gain knowledge through their pupil. This is not the case today. Rather, they confuse each other with their arguments and waste most of the day. They spend about half the day doing this. I mean, we're going to see this soon, but it seems, therefore, that half the day was allotted in pupil and half the day in real study. Their real studies are done haphazardly, but wasting time in this pupulum is a fixed part of their day. Because of the great effort that is needed in the analytical study of pupil, many have stopped learning altogether. For they say, quote, how can we be able to understand the logic that is not implicit in the text? We wish we would know what is contained in the text itself. This we're going to explain soon. If they would learn in a set manner day and night, then they would spend their entire time learning and they would eventually gain mastery over the Talmud. They would be eager to learn, for they would have the mental and emotional capacity to easily understand the material. They would always learn even when they would be slightly drowsy. Through this, they would gain a complete fear of heaven. There would also be an increase of Talmudic scholars, and they would always be involved in Torah study. Now, however, most Talmudic scholars agree that they do not learn correctly, and they know they are not learning in the straight path. Because of the great effort that they expend in their prattling, they are completely wasting their time. Because of their immense machinations in the study of pupil, they're not achieving expertise, not in Torah, prophets, holy writings, Agadata, Midrash, nor any form of wisdom. You could take it he didn't like it too much. The author of the Orchas Tzadikim was not the only critic of this new method of pupil. Here's a sampling of the literature of the 15th century regarding this new innovative pilpul and the various attitudes towards it. Here, when we begin here with Reb Moshe Mintz, we quoted before, he was a disciple of Yaakov Weil and Yisrael Isserlein, and he moved from Germany in 1462 after the Jews were expelled from Mainz, and he moved to Poland, and he was the first of the great scholars in Poland. Our Holy Torah has become forgotten because the students absent themselves from their teachers during their daily Talmudic session, which is allotted for the study of Talmud with commentary. There's the simple, and sit by themselves to deeply analyze the material. In other words, they figure that just to study it, to learn the material, they'll do that on their own quickly. And they won't sit in a shiur in a lecture to hear this. They want to spend their free time with pilpul. And he was criticizing this already. This is the middle of the 1400s. Again, from Ruchur of Yaakov Weil, this is his Rebbe. Again, this is not a direct criticism of the pilpul itself, or the overemphasis of pilpul. But rather, it seems to be that what place should pilpul be, how serious should it be taken? And he quotes here, this is from a response, that he is criticizing a ruling that was given by his contemporary, Yisrael Isserlein, the author of the Truma Sadeshin. He writes, in addition, I am amazed that such an expert, Rabbi, that's Yisrael Isserlein, whose choice separations are superior, it's a play on the word Truma Sadeshin. Truma is a special separation of the consumed sacrifices. And that was the name of the major work of Yisrael Isserlein. Should think that he would be able to rule leniently to allow a married woman to remarry on the basis of a mere inference from the wording of the text. Certainly when we are engaged in pilpul and learn incisively as in the time allotted to Tosfos, as we're going to see, part of the time it was in Tosfos man. That was the time for the Tosfos. It was then the practice to weigh arguments and to make every effort to make inferences from the text, and was to make chilukim dakim, that's to split hairs. Now, there's very, very subtle distinctions. To proverbially push an elephant through the eye of a needle. That's an expression used in the Talmud. To rule on legal matters, however, to permit something that would be otherwise forbidden can be done only on the basis of crystal clear proofs obtained from the simple reading of the source material rather than a mere inference such as this. In other words, he was not against the study of pilpul in terms of opening the mind, but it was more or less, we would view, it would seem, I mean, playing chess. In other words, it opens your mind. And open your mind to do something which is really truly constructive. But the pilpul by itself is really an exercise, more than really this is the means of making actual rulings. And really this was not something new, because this idea preceded him by some 1500 years. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, 1300 years, Rabbi Abbo said, this is on page 3, paragraph D, this is taken from Masechta Kalayim, that these arguments are appropriate were involved in the give and take of the subject matter. Was the pilpul. To rule, however, so authoritatively, is forbidden on the basis of such arguments. And so even then, and even though pilpul was highly prized, one should know what is really a rigorous proof and what really is only speculative. The Trumas Hadeshin, who was the object of the criticism before from Yaakov Weil, was actually in concurrence to this idea. And he writes, it is extremely difficult to fabricate distinctions, as this chilukim, on one's own, which are not even hinted at in the Talmud and the rulings of the Gaonim. In other words, he was criticizing the extent of what is beyond the pale already in this exercise of pilpul. It really has to be grounded in the text. And the Leket Yosher, which was a which are a compendium of the rulings of the author of a Truma Sadeshin, Yisrael Isserlein, by a Talmud of his, quotes, says, I remember that one time Yisrael Isserlein said, after making a pilpul, may the Creator forgive me for my limited understanding, because the pilpul that I just made is not worthy of having the benediction for Torah study made over it. You can't even make a Birchas HaTorah over it. It wasn't really real Torah. So he realized, even though they were not critics of the pilpul itself, but it just what place, in other words, its limitations, what place it should have. We now quote a very interesting question. We discuss that there's the pirishman, the time that's devoted to the commentaries, the study of the text, and there's the tosvosman, the time for analysis, which is really a give and take. They could theoretically have a Rebbe, a mentor, who would teach the Talmud itself and the commentaries, the simple meaning of the text, and have another mentor dealing with the pilpul. And there's a question of honoring your Rebbe, honoring your mentor. So he says as follows here, the Truma Sedeshin is on page 4. Regarding that which you wrote, says, what is the reason that the world is in the habit of saying, this is the Rav of that man, when a man learned Tosfos or Talmudic commentary from him only for a single semester, only one Zman? It's quite possible the Rav learned more from the student, more novel insights than the student learned from the Rav. Because there's always a give and take. There are questions asked. Who is to know who is the real, who is the Rebbe, like, and who is the Talmud, who is the disciple? One should not be so critical of this custom, for the custom of our forefathers is Torah. In other words, he says, you're right, but it's based on custom, and as we discussed in the last lecture, the custom is well-founded. To honor a Rebbe, even though you've learned just a short time in the period in the yeshiva. However, the Ma'arik, who was a contemporary, there's a Yosef Kolon, who was the greatest scholar in Italy at the time, who was a contemporary, a younger contemporary of the author of Truma Sedeshin, writes the following in a response. Certainly someone who studied under the Rav during the period allotted to the study of the Talmud and its commentary, the Pirishman, and the Rav directed him to discover the simple meaning of the Talmudic subject matter in a true and upright manner is considered to be his disciple and is required to honor him. He is considered to be what the Talmud calls at the end of the second chapter of Vav Metzia, quote, a master who taught him wisdom, end quote, as Rashi explains. But regarding the manner that they conduct themselves in the period allotted to Tosvos, and there's this Tosvosman, where each one articulates his unique approach to the subject, whether it be true or not, as we see again the speculative nature, I don't see any reason that one should be worthy of the title Rav. This is really, he's a coach, you know, for all the... in terms of the Tosvosman, of this, in later generations, it really came into disuse. I mean, they no longer had this separate times. And there's a question of reconstruction, what it was. And I quote here on paragraph I, it says, regarding the term used by the Maharik Tosvosman, which already was no many years later, it is already in the early 1700s, late 1600s, early 1700s, it no longer was in use. I heard from the master, the Gaon Rav Moshe, blessed memory, the author of the Chelkas Mechokok, that in the time of the Maharik, it was the custom to study for one term, which lasted for half a year, the Halachas, Talmudic subjects without Tosvos, till the entire material which they learned during that time was fluent in their mouths. Afterwards, in the second period, which also lasted a half a year, they studied the Tosvos pertaining to the material they previously studied the semester before with great depth. They would call this period Tosvosman. However, from what we've seen before from the Orchas Tzaddikim, it seems really that in terms of part of the day was allotted for the commentary and part was, you know, really went side by side every single day. And that seems to be what we have on page 5, an eyewitness account of what the yeshiva was like of Rabbi Yehuda Padua. And there's Yehuda Mintz, which we just, again, also, he was a cousin of Moshe Mintz, who studied from Yaakov Vale and Rishol Isserlein. He also left Mainz in the year 1462. He settled in Padua in Italy, was a contemporary, a colleague of the Maharik, and brought with him as the Germanic approach. It seems from what the Maharik, how he criticized, I don't know if that was the approach in his yeshiva, how he criticized the pilpul. But this was the approach, definitely, in the German yeshivas, and it was brought into Italy. Now, this is what he writes. This is from Eliyahu Kapsali. The family were great Turkish Sephardic scholars. But he visited, he was a student in this yeshiva of Yehuda Mintz. And he writes, after the completion of prayers, the Rav, from the referring to Yehuda Mintz, would walk with his students to the small house that was in the courtyard of the large synagogue of Padua. This was called the yeshiva. At that time, the other rabbis and scholars with their students would gather, and the Rav would begin to ask questions, and each one would answer him, each according to his rank. Afterwards, each one would ask and answer and bring to light that which was hidden, as they would be studying on their own. This was called the pilpul of the yeshiva. Each one would be engaged in pilpul with his learning partner, which was suited to his level of competence. The pilpul was conducted outside. I mean to say by this that no sefer book was opened at the time. This was because they were conversant with Talmudic subject material. The only sefer that was present with them was the Talmud of the Rav, which he used to show them the halacha. The halacha is the term used here, we're going to see, is referring to the whole Talmudic subject under discussion, known as the sugya. They would sit there in the yeshiva for more or less about an hour. This was based upon the pilpul and the need for the discussion of the particular halacha. The end of this hour or so, the Rav would open his sefer and point out to them the correct extent that one should delve into this halacha so they would not unnecessarily add to it or decrease from it. Afterwards, each one would go to their respective homes and each master would teach his students the halacha that would be covered the next day. The same manner the Rosh Yeshiva would teach his own students. Now, so the beginning of the day would be for this free-for-all, this open discussion. And it seems even the Rosh Yeshiva did not deliver a detailed discourse on his own, some brilliant analysis, but really went through the Talmud itself and pointed out the as a mentor, as a coach. We're going to see that seems to have changed already by the 16th century, where the Rosh Yeshiva really gave a brilliant discourse on his own, rather than focusing the students on their own, on their own approach to this pilpul. To give you a sense of what was like in the yeshiva in the early morning, when they're all asking back and forth, again, this is on page 5, on this number 3. This is taken from a manuscript found in the National Library of Paris around the time, of Yehuda Padua. And he writes, each one would draw near, this one would talk, and this one would answer. This one would expound, this one would recite a Mishnah, this one would destroy, and the other one would build. The sound of war would be heard in the encampment. So it would be like everyone's screaming at each other. Not everyone looked at this very fondly, as we say on top of page 6. This is from another document was taken at the time. The debate was for the most part not based on truth. This work was called pilpul, but others rightfully called it bilbul, confusion. Scriptures and Talmud lay in a cabinet without a seeker and anyone to request them. Only he who preoccupies himself with pilpul is considered sacred. He is the leader and general of the people, even if he knows nothing else besides. He didn't take this too kindly. Another one who didn't take too kindly to this is a scholar described by Yehuda Kapsali, that we've quoted before, who visited the yeshiva of Yehuda Mintz, Marie Mintz. Rav Chaim Karmi was an outstanding scholar, originally came from France. He did not come to the yeshiva of Yehuda Mintz of Padua to participate because he took a different approach in his studies. And here we hear the echoes of the Orach HaTzaddikim, and for all we know, he may have been the author himself. My father, may his rock and redeemer guard him, beseeched his master, Yehuda Mintz, to engage Rav Chaim Karmi in pilpul. And this they did, as they invited him. In fact, the students held their discussions in the yeshiva in the holy tongue in order that he too would understand. It's not clear what it was in Yiddish or Italian. It could be very well. It was in Yiddish that he came from France, and he's already at that time, this was Provence. He didn't know Yiddish, so they had it all in Hebrew. But when Reb Chaim saw they did not act towards each other in a calm and respectful manner in their halachic discussions, he forsook the yeshiva and never returned. There's a sense of... I would like to now discuss, what was this pilpul? We've danced around the pilpul. What were the questions that they asked? What were the answers? What was this? And because it's really something that's, to a great extent, we don't do this anymore. The great yeshivas, they don't do this anymore. And it has tremendous historic value, because if you'll read any historic work, they're always speaking about the criticism of Pilpel. So what was Pilpel? See, here we are on page 6. I'm quoting now from Yitzhak Kanpantón, who was the greatest scholar in Spain in the middle of the 15th century, who was not an advocate of the speculative Pilpel, but was really was an advocate of solid, rigorous scholarship. But many of the approaches, though, lent themselves to what we would call the speculative Pilpel. And this is what it is. We start here on paragraph J. Earnestly look into every statement and argument of the Talmud and see what you would have inferred from the text or have logically deduced on your own prior to the statement made by that Tana or Amora. Notice when that scholar of the Mishnah or the period of the Talmud. Because when you have a statement, evidently he's telling you something you wouldn't have thought of yourself. What would you have, had you not heard this from him, what would you have thought otherwise? You would thereby receive a tremendous benefit from this. For if you came to the same conclusion on your own, then you have to ask yourself the question, what did he come to tell us? It's so obvious. If I could think of it, you know, evidently must be obvious. And he must be telling me something, you know, that it must be, evidently it's not that obvious, you know. If your logic contradicts his, then you have to understand and think about what forced him into his position and what is the weakness or flaw with your own logic. This is called, quote, Sevora Mibachutz. It was the outsider superficial logic. And we're going to go back again just to understand the critique of Pilpel now from the Orchas Tzadikim, which we quoted before in the bottom of page 6. He says, because of the great effort that is needed in the analytical study of Pilpel, many have stopped learning altogether, for they say, quote, how can we ever be able to understand the logic that is not implicit in the text Svora Mibachutz? The outside or superficial logic, we wish we would know what is contained in the text itself. Because what do I have to worry? What would I have thought if he didn't say this? Forget it, he said it, let's go on further. In other words, if I'm just busy, what would he have thought if he didn't say this? You know, so I'm just busy thinking, maybe he meant this, maybe it's that, maybe it's this, maybe that. He said, it gets so hard, people just stop learning altogether. Just learn. You know, and that was again the approach of the Orchas Tzadik. But what he comes really to criticize would seem to be, at least partially, is this approach, this Svora Mibachutz. Of course, the Orchas Tzadikim was a critic, and it would seem the majority of scholars, though, embraced this. And again, on page 7, this is now referring, before he was speaking with Yitzhak Kanpantón, as Darkei HaGemara was referring to understand the text of the Talmud. Now he says, how do you understand the commentators? You learn Rashi, you learn Tosfos. There's a portion of the Talmud, and they comment on it, and he says, this is the way we should understand this particular statement. He says, if you want to know the intent of the commentator and to know what alternative explanation or logical argument he's coming to reject or exclude, because again, this is the Svora Mibachutz, in other words, Yaltsa, look carefully into his commentary. He was careful to word it in order to invite one who would attempt to contradict, oppose, or challenge it to read it. And then, by careful reading, you will know that this is the point that the author wanted to guard against. Says, don't explain it that way, but explain it this way. The next step is to seek compelling evidence to support his explanation over the one that he's contradicting. In effect, asking yourselves, why did he choose this explanation over the other one? It's because any commentary has committed himself to a certain approach. You read a text, and you say, well, this is what it means. So you say, well, evidently, if he's committing himself, evidently there were other options. There are perhaps other commentators who have a different approach. So why did he take this? What did he see in this approach that, you know, that was so compelling? So these are the questions you have to ask yourself when you study. And again, generally, we don't do this anymore. It's just interesting. One who is an advocate of this, again, he was, it would seem to be a disciple, at least of not directly of Yitzhak Kanpantón, but a disciple of a disciple of his. This is from the Kolei Shmuel, written by Shmuel Sedilio, who was from those who were expelled from Spain in 1492. One to whom the power of splitting, like splitting hairs, comes easily, will find the alternative commentary the Tosfos guarded against. This is not so hard. Again, this is at least part of what the pupil they're referring to. Besides for the area of research pointed out by Rav Yitzchak Khan Panton, the pupilistic approach opened up several other interesting areas of inquiry. My first quote is from Yeshaya Horovitz, one of the leading rabbis of the 17th century and author of the classic work Shnei Luchos HaBris. The author is widely known by an abbreviation of that work, Shiloh, or Shiloh HaKodesh, the holy author of the Shiloh. He also happened to be a very outspoken critic of the new pupil. His criticism was based not on the areas of inquiry per se, that he held in the highest regard, but rather the extremely speculative approach that his contemporaries took to answer these questions. And here is what he said. And again, I think it's just important to realize, even though one is not necessarily a student of the Talmud, but to realize from a historical viewpoint, what were they doing? And what was the criticism that was, that the critics so vociferously wrote against? And again, this is now Yeshaya Horovitz writing. This is in the Shiloh, the portion which is called Masechet Shavuos. This alone is the fulfillment of the commandment of learning Torah, and to it you shall cling. With it you will gain acuity, meaning the ability to answer the following difficulties in truthful ways. In other words, versus the speculative pupil. All Eisbringer problems. I don't know if you ever had these problems in your life, but these were the problems. He calls the Eisbringers, which we're going to see all Nuremberg problems, all Regensburg problems. Later historians had a terrible time understanding what these were. But again, this maybe it fell into disuse. What are they? Some say the word Eisbringer was really a Yiddishism of the word Augsburg. Augsburg was a town in Germany, which otherwise was really not known for its Talmudic scholarship. But viewing this, they felt, it must be referring, just like Nuremberg is a town and Regensburg is a town, Eisbringer must also be a town. The only one that would fit in would be Augsburg. But as we're going to say, truth is really this is not so. We're going to explain what this Eisbringer is. The problem of tying together every v'im tomar, in the Tosfos there's a question, and it's produced v'im tomar, if you say, if you ask the following question, or tema is a wonder, a seemingly insolvable question, stated in the middle of a Tosfos with below zos. This is a term meaning when you ask a question in the middle of the Tosfos, again, this was the approach of the Balei Pilpul, would say, why did Tosfos ask the question here? Why didn't he ask it before? Why is it just here? It must be it's connected with the previous part of the Tosfos. What triggered this question? So he says, so what's below Zos? Means without this, I wouldn't have asked the question. Without the previous part of the Tosfos, the question could not be asked. These things are included in true Torah study. They also sharpen the mind. Certainly someone who learns Talmud, commentary, Tosfos faithfully every single day, paying attention to all its textual inferences, both in the official semester and in between semesters, he was a critic of taking off vacation time, Shiloh. And he went in the path of his father's Rebbe, the Maral of Prague, was also a very strong opponent of taking off time. Now, if you really want to become a scholar, you have to put in the time and don't take the vacation time. Only someone who does this will become a true scholar. I'm just quoting now from on page 8, a work which was written at the end of the 17th century. There are not many extant works about Pilpul because it fell out of fashion, and it's really hard to reconstruct what really they're talking about. But there's one work which is a Pilpulistic work written, this is called Ale de Yonah, written by Yonah ben Yamin Zed. And he writes in the introduction about what his all the problems that his work will address. And he says, also every tema and v'yei shlomer, again the tema is this wonder, this amazing, difficult question, and v'yei shlomer, which is understood to be as a, quote, kal v'chomer, will be addressed in my work. This really is normally a kal v'chomer, as it's normally understood, is if a person, if metal will melt at 300 degrees, it will most certainly melt at 500 degrees. You know, it's kal v'chomer. You know, the easy thing will cause this effect. The more severe thing most certainly will cause the effect. You can't understand. This makes any sense here, and we're going to explain this soon. But he said this all in rhyme. Says, you know, with the help of he who does and says, also every fear and oath bringer. Notice, you don't have just the oath bringer here, you have a fear bringer. So what's a fear bringer? It was bad enough with the oath bringer. And Regensburger in the Talmud are correctly addressed. So now we're going to say, what is the oath bringer? And it's interesting to understand what the oath bringer is really the source, the fine. There's an amazing sefer. It's called Meleches Machsheves by a someone who survived the war. Came to England, a tremendous scholar, Nachman Shlomo Greenspan, who wrote this sefer. In the beginning of the sefer, in the beginning of the work, he has a whole preface into the study of Pilpul, again, which is a historic study because it's not done anymore. And he deals with this oath. What does this mean? And he tracked it down. And is this they found a source, how in the context you understand what it's referring to. And really the source is this Ala de Yona, and what it's referring to is a quote. Now I'm quoting from the Shalah, and this quote, he doesn't call this oath bringer, but it's clear from other sources, this is the oath bringer that he was referring to. What is this? I'll just give you a little background before we quote the Shalah. The Talmud very often deals with, you know, it's a matter of, it's full of questions. Statements are made, and statements are challenged. Very often, Amora, the scholars of the Talmud, make a statement, and they're challenged by statements from the Mishnah or the Brisa, which is work from the same period, which is more authoritative. Now, a Brisa, you know, are really chapters or whole books, and very often what they could quote is just a sentence from a Brisa, like a sentence from a Mishnah, or a whole paragraph. There are situations where to challenge a statement, all I have to do is just quote a sentence. You know, I quote from this Brisa, a sentence, and I say, hey, this is, what you've said seems to contradict this more authoritative source. There are times, though, that not a single sentence is quoted, the sentence which is really the contradiction, but the whole paragraph of which the sentence is part of. It really doesn't seem to be necessary to quote the whole paragraph. All you have to quote is that single sentence. Why is it that sometimes only sentences are quoted to refute, you know, a statement? And how comes, why is a whole paragraph quoted that where all you needed to quote was just a single sentence in there? Is, what did you have to bring the beginning? Bring is brengen in Yiddish. And fear is like the word, to the fore. In other words, before. In other words, the front. If the end would be sufficient, why do you have to bring the beginning? That's the fear bringer. Or if the beginning would suffice, what do you have to bring the end? That's the ice bringer. And the question is, so why give us all this, you know, information? In other words, just quote that part which we need to know. Why do you have to give us all this other information? That's the question. So he says on page 8, Bryce's quote in the Talmud are sometimes quoted in their entirety and sometimes quoted succinctly. At times the questioner quotes an entire Bryce when he only needed to quote the beginning and not the end. Similarly, the beginning of the Bryce may not at all be pertinent. The only end should have been quoted. Now look in the bold type. Now this is where Pilpul begins. The Rosh Yeshivas take the approach the entire Brisa was quoted in presenting the question, because otherwise an alternative answer could have been suggested. But now that the entire Brisa was quoted, the seemingly unnecessary part actually contradicts the alternate answer. Because we need to give you all the information, because you know that one sentence, you could have come to something else. But if you have the whole thing, seeing the whole thing, you see, that's not an option. This is actually a proper path to take on a condition that is reasonable. I mean to say that the contradiction to the alternate answer is immediately evident by looking at the seemingly unnecessary part that is quoted. If, however, the contradiction is only built upon a contrived pilpul, then it is evident that this is not what the questioner had in mind. There is, however, a true insight into this matter, which I found, which was quoted in the name of Yitzhak de Leon, a blessed memory, and he was a disciple of Yitzhak Tanpanton. He wrote that there was a... Now, this is more what we call a scholarly approach to this question. You know, we call it like a more modern approach. That there was a need to include that Bryce into the corpus of the Talmud like every other Tana Rabbanan that is set into the Talmud. Part of writing the Talmud, or quoting all these Bryces, was to preserve all this material. There are many, most of the Bryces there have are lost. Some of them were preserved in the Tosefta, some in the Toras Kohanim, the Sefra, some in the Sefrei and Bamidbar in Dvorim, some in the Mechilta, but some is preserved in the Talmud. Sometimes it would seem to be extraneous information is brought there, nor it should be forgotten. So really he could have quoted just that sentence. So that's what he writes. And since the Bryce was... He wrote that there was a need to include the Bryce into the corpus of Talmud like every Tana Rabbanan. And since the Bryce was quoted by the questioner, the entire Bryce was quoted. Now the Shulah is writing, continues on himself, and he says, it seems to me that the questioner only quoted the part that was necessary for the question. In other words, when it was actually quoted in the yeshiva, they only quoted the question. The only that sentence that was the direct confrontation. It was the editor of the Talmud quoted in its entirety in order to make it part of the corpus of the Talmud. So here we have two different approaches entirely. One is very speculative. Why was it quoted? Because it enhanced the question. You had to figure out why it enhanced the question. And the other is you dismiss the whole is not a problem whatsoever. The whole thing is to preserve as much information as possible, and they quoted as much, including the kitchen sink, and they just put everything in. Like, very different approaches. But one allows tremendous speculation. Because this is the Eisbringer. Now, what is the Nuremberger? We find many instances in the Talmud when two Amoraim disagree, that the questioner will first challenge one of the Amoraim. This is from the Shulah again. He doesn't call this Nuremberger. But we know from a quote from the Maharam Schiff, who's one of the greats of the 17th century, in a quote, in a passage in Bava Metzia, in Ezan Neshech, that he refers to this, calls this the Nuremberger. So we see that this is what he's referring to. When two Amoraim disagree, that the questioner will first challenge one of the Amoraim on the basis of Mishnah or Brisa. The answer will offer a satisfactory response. Then the questioner will then turn around and challenge the second Amora, basing himself upon a different Mishnah or Brisa. In other words, two people are arguing, A and B. I look at A and I says, how could you be right? And I'll quote him a certain Brisa. Then I turn to B and, how could you be right? And I'll quote him another Brisa. So the question is, well, one Bryce is supporting the other one's position, right? And this one's supporting this one's position. Then we got problems with two Bryces. I mean, they're problematic as it is. In other words, Rav Huna will say, this is mutter. Rav Yehuda says, no, this is usur, it's forbidden. Says, I look to Rav Huna and say, you say it's permitted. I quote a Bryce, says it's forbidden. Then I look to Rav Yehuda and says, you say it's forbidden, huh? Well, I'll quote your Bryce as it's permitted. Okay, so we've challenged them. But isn't that a little strange? You've got two Bryces by themselves that are contradicting each other. That's the Nuremberger. We got it. As he says, behold, there's an inherent problem here. Putting aside the argument between the two Amoraim, how did the questioner understand the Mishnah or Brisa that contradicted each other based upon the questioner's understanding? Why didn't he directly point out the contradiction without bringing up these Amoraim? You have two Brisa. One says it's mutter. One says it's also. Well, ask the question directly. What do you have to involve these people for? That's the Nuremberger. The Rosh Yeshivas, as it's being about the Balei Pilpul, take many different brilliant approaches to answer such a question. In order not to veer from the truth, I say that if it is possible to present a third logical position, there would be midway between the positions of those Amoraim, then one should do so. For instance, this Amora forbids in all circumstances. And the other allows it in all circumstances. The questioner thought to forbid it in one situation, allow it in another. He had a way to resolve the contradiction. In other words,
it's usser on Tuesday and it's mutter on Wednesday. You know, he had a way of resolving this.
But the one who says it's permitted says permitted both Tuesday and Wednesday, and the one who says forbidden is forbidden both Tuesday and Wednesday. Well, then we got a problem. He didn't have a problem resolving this. If we'd be a little more flexible, you know, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. But if you're inflexible, so then we got a problem. But you have to think about the Tuesday. Well, Tuesday may not be such a good, I don't know of anything which is Tuesday and Wednesday. But, you know, the idea that, you know, sometimes yes, sometimes no, and I find a middle ground, and the two who are arguing, though, don't have a middle ground. Oh, then I have something. For instance, this Amar forbids in all circumstances, the other allows in all circumstances. The question of thought to forbid in one situation allows it in another. With this approach, the apparent contradiction of the Mishnah's of Brises could be resolved. This material does pose problems for the other Amoraim, however, who do not take this middle position. This is a straight path if you can work it out. Even if you can't, it does not seem to me that there's anything strained by saying. Now, this is the first approach is the pilpalistic approach. Now we're taking a non-pilpalistic approach. He says, it doesn't seem to me there's anything strained by saying that there are two different questions, not the same man. Because we had a problem, one brought up this, one brought up the other, and this one man knew both Brises. Could be there are two people here. The answer of the first question turns around and presents a new challenge to the other Amor. Similarly, I believe that this is the correct approach to understand the entire composition of the Talmud. In other words, when you have the Gemara ask the question on one, ask the question on the other, it seems it's the same person. But it's not necessarily so. It could be two different people. And neither one has had the complete knowledge. It's like, you know, in the classroom, one person raises his hand. Hey, what do you do? Another person on the back of their hand. Hey, what about this? It is not necessarily it's the same person. Even though they refer to it as the anonymous questioner answer, still in all, it makes no sense to say that the questioner only asks questions and no answers. In other words, there's one who's a dedicated questioner. And the answer only answers questions, never asks any questions. Because there's always, the Makshin is a Tartzin, right? This guy got a degree as a Makshin. He only asks questions. The other one is an answer, you know? Rather, the truth is that two enlightened individuals were involved in the give and take of the discussion of Pilpul in order to understand the plumb the depths of the subject matters. At times this one will ask, the other will answer. At times the roles will reverse, as the norm of two people involved in Torah study. So again, this non-pilpalistic approach says the kasha hepsach nishtonet. In other words, there's no, the question doesn't even start. The whole basis of your question is one man knows both Brises. You know, and you have to give a thing that why wasn't he bothered by this? Because you have a Tuesday and Wednesday or whatever. It's two people. You know, it's the one who said that it's mutter, you know, knew that Bryson. The other one who says also knew that Bryson. There was no one man who knew both, who was able to, should have really asked the question directly. And then we have a problem, why didn't he? And we have to create some novel, brilliant explanation. They're two separate people. But that's the Nuremberger. So when you think about Nuremberg, don't just think about the trials. Okay? Next is Regensburger. Very often we find in the Talmud that after a problem, this is also, to identify this, this is also taken from the Shalah, but he doesn't identify with the word Regensburger. However, there's another quote from the Maram Shif on a Gemara in Shabbos and Kuftes Vovo and Beis. That clearly refers, calls this the Regensburg. Very often we find in the Talmud that after a problem is presented to a certain scholar and the scholar offers a solution, then the one who originally presented the problem will immediately contradict the solution that was offered by quoting a contradictory Mishnah or Brisa. Notice, I ask you, is this allowed? And the Rav says, Avada, Samutar. It's allowed. That can't be Mutar. Well, there's a Brisa, there's a Mishnah. The question, you know, if you're so smart, what are you asking me for? If you knew this, what are you asking? That's the Regensburg. Since the one who presented the problem was already aware of the Mishnah of Brisa, why did he present the problem in the first place? And I'm quoting from the Shalom. He already knew the solution. The answer that I received from my mentors to this question was that the problem presented in the Talmud reflected a real-life situation which the presenter was reluctant to rule upon himself, that presented it to his mentor and to someone else who was greater than he. Even though, in his opinion, he already knew what the correct course of action should be, he was reluctant to implement it on his own. His mentor, who answered the query and ruled on the issue, either permissibly or stringently, was then challenged by the presenter by information that pointed to an opposite solution. This approach is valid only if the presenter of the problem was a student of the one who offered the solution. Because I wouldn't paskin this myself, I wouldn't rule myself. I come to someone who's greater than I. In that case, we can say that a real-life problem came to the presenter's attention. If the problem, however, was presented by the members of the yeshiva as a whole, then this approach is somewhat strained, because they weren't, the yeshiva there is not ruling on something. They're just, it's only academic. Well, if they know the answer, what are they asking the question? There's, again, in the boldface type, there's yet another approach to deal with this question. Again, this is the Regensburger approach. In actuality, the problem that was presented consisted of two facets. The one who presented the problem had a resolution, ruling either stringently or leniently to one facet of the problem. The real problem that needed a resolution, and that he actually presented, was the second facet. Now, there are two parts to this problem. One of them he knew, and he had the brisa to support it. The other problem, the other part, the way he understood the brisa, it really is not all that clear. The scholar who resolved the problem, and as again we take with the Tuesdays and the Wednesdays, just to make it, he knew, says Tuesdays it's for sure usher. The brisa says it's usher. Wednesdays he wasn't so sure about. Yeah? So his problem really, when he came to ask the question, he was really asking about Wednesday. The scholar who resolved the problem, either leniently or stringently, offered the same solution to both facets of the problem. The facet the presenter already decided, the Tuesday, and the facet that was still undecided. So therefore, Tuesdays he knew about already. Let's say Tuesdays is usher. Wednesdays he's not sure. And he goes and says, the one who answers the shaila says, it's mutter. And the way he said it is a way it's clearly, it's mutter Tuesdays and it's always mutter. She's asking, wait a minute here. You know, Wednesdays maybe. Tuesdays can't be. This is Bryson. Regarding this dual solution that the presenter challenged his decision on the basis of the mission of the Bryson, i.e. the solution you offer to the first facet is not correct. Because I really have a Wednesday problem. Tuesdays I never would have come to you for. She says, and you answer my question, and the way you answered it, it comes out that Tuesdays, you say, it's also mutter. Can't be. Tuesdays, I know it can't be. This is a valid approach, provided the one does not veer from the truth and makes every effort to understand all of this very well. In other words, it shouldn't be speculative. It should really be rigorous. But when it's speculative, that's pilpul. Again, it lends itself to tremendous areas of imagination. So you could see what the attraction was. Again, finally, we'll give you a degree as a mefalpel soon after you finish this course here. The im timer yesh lomar says and tema. Again, the explanation for every im tomar and the yesh lomar is as follows. In written, it's a question brought in the Tosfos commentary is preceded by the im tomar. If you say to yourself, im tomar, if you say this, if you say, I want to ask this particular question, so v'yesh lomer, there is to say in response, don't do so because you could answer it in the following manner. If you think this, no, you're wrong, we can say this. If the Tosa states the question is tema, an incredible difficulty, it generally means that the question remains unanswered. I mean, that's usually when, you know, 90% of the thing when Tosa says tema, it's really a pella. I mean, it remains unresolved. Sometimes, however, there's a v'yesh lomer after a tema. So why is it? Like, if it was so difficult, if it's answered, then it can't be so bad. Then just say simply v'im tomar to the yesh lomer, which is like the standard form. Why the tema? Why is it such an astounding question? It's possible that the answer is contained, this is again from the Shalal, this, in the v'yesh, yeah, it's possible that the answer contained the v'yesh lomer can be challenged from some other source. even though it is a satisfactory answer when dealing solely with the question at hand. In other words, this question is a major question. We could partially answer the question, as the part that says, with this answer, but it's only a partial answer. The partial answer, though, so there's an easy part to this question, which can easily be answered, and a difficult part which doesn't. We quoted before the Kal Vachomer that was quoted before here on page 8. It's like this. As you just top of page 8, also every tema of Yishlom, which is understood to be as a Kal Vachomer, means the Kal is part of this question is easy, and that I can answer, and part is it, there's Chomer is difficult, and it still remains unanswered. Yeah, the Rosh Hashivas generally take a many-faceted approach to resolve the problem of Yishlom after a tema. Every pupil is fine as long as the words that are stated, whether to support the structure or destroy the structure, entirely reflect the truth. Regarding a Ve'im Tomer, which is in the middle of a Tosfos, and this is the problem of below Zos. And as you're asking in the middle, what are you asking this now for? It is not apparently connected to the previous statement. If you can make the effort to analyze it well and to connect it to the previous part of the Tosfos in a truthful manner, how wonderful, how beautiful a feat. If it does not lend itself to any connection, it is not essential. Don't spend the time. Therefore, be careful not to connect it to a non-substantive manner and to only create a multiplicity of empty statements. Only place your portion of the Torah of truth. But again, you have now a sense of what Pilpul dealt with. As we stated before, in the 15th century, the yeshiva in Nuremberg, this is called the Nuremberg question, was a well known for its preeminence in the field of Pilpul. This is really coined. In other words, that question was associated with this yeshiva, because they were very adept answering, you know, this kind of a question. You know, that was the one man who knows the Brisa, you know, the Tuesdays and the Wednesdays. One of the outstanding products of that yeshiva, originally native of Poland, was Rav Yaakov Polak, a leading disciple of Nuremberg's Rosh Yeshiva, a Rav going Rav Yaakov Margolis. He later went on to become what historians deem to be the foremost exponent of Pilpul. This is what the 16th century historian, Rav David Gans, wrote about him in his classic work, Tzemach David. This is in the bottom here, page 11. The reputation of Rav Yaakov Polak is well known from one end of the earth to the other. He was a Rosh Hashiva and Av Beis Din, head of the rabbinical court, together with Isaac Margolis, here in the holy community of Prague. He passed away around the year 1530. His reporter of Yaakov Polak, through his tremendous acuity and sharpness of mind, was the first to introduce the Pilpul method of Chilukim. I guess they introduced this into Poland. Or alternately, we're going to see that Chilukim was named not only as it was used in the 15th century, you know, for fine distinctions, but really that was the name for the whole Pilpulistic discourse. There was some brilliant discourse that was made by the Rosh Yeshivas. It is practiced by the Rosh Yeshivas in these countries in order to sharpen the minds of the students, notwithstanding the fact that their approach is not accepted by any of the wise scholars upright in their hearts. The Tzemach David was a Talmud of the Ramah, it was the subject of the next lecture, and also a Talmud of the Maral of Prague, who was a very vociferous critic of Pilpul. The great and wondrous leaders of the generation are not pleased with this method of study. While in Prague, Yaakov Polak married Esther Fischelis, the daughter of Rachel, a wealthy widow. Her support enabled him to devote his total energies to the study and teachings of Torah. His orphan sister-in-law, Sulka, became the wife of David Senner. Since Sulka was an orphaned minor at the time, her marriage was not valid according to Torah law, which demands in the absence of the girl's father, both the bride and groom be adults. As her father had died, she was still a minor. Such a marriage is only sanctioned rabbinically, as it's done through the intervention of the girl's mother or brothers who are involved in creating this marriage. The rabbis instituted such a marriage in order to protect and provide for orphan girls below age who are often in vulnerable circumstances. Sulka's marriage, unfortunately, did not work out. Normally, a marriage can only be terminated by a get, a divorce document given by the husband. In the case of an orphan minor like Sulka, where the whole marriage was only rabbinically sanctioned, there's yet another way of effecting a divorce. If the wife who is still a minor comes before Beis Din, the court, and declares before them she wishes to invalidate the marriage, it becomes terminated even without a get. The process is called miyun, or rejection. This miyun, which was supported by a brother-in-law of Yaakov Polak, was bitterly contested by the other rabbis of that generation. Their position was to a great deal based on legislation that had been issued some 50 years before Rav Menachem of Mürzburg, who was one of the leading rabbis in Germany from Saxony. As a result, Rav Yaakov Polak became embroiled in a controversy that forced him to leave his position, eventually settling in Krakow, Poland. In fact, it seems that time doesn't allow to quote here. I quote from a responsum from Rav Yehuda Mintz, whom we quoted before, who brings the details of this story. And it seems that Rav Yaakov Polak was excommunicated by his former Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Margolis, because he took a stance against the legislation by Rav Menachem Mürzburg. It's not clear, we don't have in writing what Rav Yaakov Polak's approach was. Now just to touch upon this before we go further, you could read the story inside on page 13. There's an inherent problem by creating a rabbinic marriage. A marriage is valid, has in it two clear ramifications. First of all, if a woman is married, if someone else marries that woman, as gives her kesef kedushin, gives her a ring, this is harayat mekudeshesli, goes to a marriage ceremony, it's invalid, because you're married to the first. The second is, one is not allowed to marry a woman's sister. If a woman's sister, who is not married at the time, he's married to the one woman, A. He then goes, turns around, and gives kedushin to her sister, B. It's not valid, because you cannot marry, says, your wife's sister. It has no validity. As long as your wife is still alive, it has no validity. But what's about a rabbinic marriage? Let's say this minor was married rabbinically, and now she's an adult. The marriage was not consummated. They didn't have marital relations afterwards, the first marriage. Her marriage is only still sanctioned only rabbinically. Then another person comes to this woman and gives her a real kedushin, gives her a kesef kedushin, gives her a ring, zarat mekudeshesli. Well, the second one is valid according to Torah law. The first one is only rabbinical, and she would need a get from the second one. Or take the situation again. The man is married to a woman, right? Rabbinically. And this is, again, she's an orphan girl, not through her father. She's orphaned by her father. It was done through her mother. She was a minor, her mother, her brother. And then the man goes and turns to this woman's, girl's older sister, who's an adult, and she's single, and he's mekadesh her. He says, gives her a ring, hariat mekadeshes li, you're betrothed to me. It's valid according to Torah law. Rabbinically, he shouldn't be doing this, but according to Torah law, it's valid. How are the rabbis going to protect that such a thing does not happen? The people don't confuse from rabbinic law, a rabbinically sanctioned marriage, to a Torah-sanctioned marriage. So I believe, this is how Rav Yaakov Polak understood this. It was ensured by the fact that since the rabbinically sanctioned marriage can be broken through this miyun, it could be broken easily just by this going to the courts, everyone will know it's only rabbinical, since it's treated differently than a Torah marriage. So, if it's treated differently, there's no problem of kilkel, there's no problem of that any problems will arise from this, because people will know it's only a rabbinical marriage. But once a Menachem of Merzburg said, you can't make a miyun, and I guess he was worried of the misuse of forcing this girl of rejection. Maybe she'll be pressured. There's the reasons why the family, maybe she would be offered a higher dowry from some other groom, and she would reject this. Probably a misuse, but he said, you can't be done. Well, if it can't be done, then we have a problem. Then people will start thinking that this is really a Torah. This is a real marriage. And they'll have the other, they'll treat it like a real marriage. You get real problems here. What happens if somebody else gives her kedushin? Or the husband gives kedushin to this woman's sister? And it could be that's why Rav Yaakov Pollack says that no Beis Din has the right to stop the practice of miyun, because by doing so, they're really contravening the wishes of Chazal, who really created this in the first place. Of course, his contemporaries disagreed with this. They put him in cherem. He left Krakow. He did not recant. And on page 14, here we quote from the Shulchan Aruch. What is the halacha is like Rav Yaakov Pollack? It's interesting here. This is quoted from the Ramah. It's worthwhile for you just on your own to see the notes on page 13. There were those who, this has been the Shulchan Aruch, that we should not be stringent today and not make miyun after the girl is 12 years old, even though she was examined and they did not find two pubic hairs. Nor did they have marital relations after she reached the age of 12. As long as she is a minor, she is allowed to make miyun, to make this rejection. Once she becomes an adult, according to the halacha, then it's too late. The problem is adulthood is not just created by age, but also by signs of physical maturity, which the minimal is two pubic hairs. This is a sign that the body already, the hormones, the growth hormone, the hormones that take effect have begun to take effect. If what happens if a person is 12 years old, a girl, and we've checked her and there's no pubic hairs, but there's a possibility, you know, but maybe she had them and they fell off. I mean, it's rare, but it's within the range of possibility. That's why the same thing is a bachar bar mitzvah. You know, it's 13 years old. Really, according to the halacha, it's not just 13 years. It's 13 years plus the physical signs. We normally assume that they go hand in hand. But if you check them and you didn't find the physical signs, we still say, but maybe, you know, if it comes to Torah law, you know, if it's going to be questioned of an adult. You have a boy who's 13 years of age. He doesn't have two pubic hairs. But he gives a ring to a woman who is definitely an adult. Is an Ariat Mekudeshes Li. We don't dismiss it. If he'd be 8 years old, we dismiss it. If he's 13 years old, even though we don't see it, how do you know? Maybe he did have it. Maybe it was taken off. Maybe this, maybe that. We don't play games. So there's a question, what do you do with in terms of miyun of a girl who is 12 years of age, but we don't have pubic hairs? That's what the Shulchan Aruch is referring to. But it's clear from the Shulchan, if she's less than 12, for sure we practice miyun. Okay, after we realize the Shulchan Aruch is from Yosef Karo, it's from the Spanish school. The Ramah, this is the Moshe Isserles, who was a disciple of Rav Yaakov Pollack, writes, according to all opinions, if she is less than 12, she can invalidate the marriage, you know, quoting in the inference from the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, even in the present day, this is a ruling which Rav Yaakov Pollack of Blessed Memory made in his own lifetime. This ruling differs with those who are stringent and say that no girl should make miyun in the present day. And he quotes this from Aram Mirzburg and Rav Yehuda Mintz, this is the previous quote. And the Sefer Yam Shel Shlomo, which was written by Shlomo Luria, which is going to be in 4 weeks of Mirz Hashem, the topic. Because of his prestige and greatness, he relied on his own opinion to validate the miyun and did not pay attention to them, those who nor to their decrees. The woman Sulka got married to another man on the basis of that miyun. Eventually, Rav Yaakov Pollack, after he left Prague, moved to Krakow and was appointed as chief rabbi of Krakow and the rest of Poland. Well, there were those who sided evidently with Rav Yaakov Pollack. Rav Yaakov Pollack, evidently they saw, seems to have been the superior of all of those of that generation. That's what they felt. He was so brilliant. And we quote at the bottom of page this is 14, his appointment by the king of Poland. It's not poshado to be put into cherem. You know, it's not simple to be excommunicated, because every excommunication carries with it a curse. And this was not the only time he was excommunicated, at least according to one story. After 30 years in Poland, a fresh controversy erupted, this time between Rav Yaakov Polak and Rav Yehuda Mintz's son, Rav Avraham Mintz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Padua. This is the account according to the Sefer Shalshelis HaKabbalah. But just a word of caution before we begin reading this. The author of that work was an uncritical compiler of stories and reports. Many of the stories reported in that work are either partially or wholly untrue, which we've quoted some of them in previous lectures. It is also important to keep in mind that the rabbis of that era, like Rav Avraham Mintz, the chief rabbi of Padua, Rav Yaakov Polak, the chief rabbi of Krakow, were people of tremendous sitkus, integrity, and piety. Now, this is the story. I heard a report of an incident that occurred in Bologna, where one Jew entrusted 12,000 gold pieces for safekeeping with another Jew as a shomer chinam, in other words, to do it for free, as a favor. When the owner came back to take his property, the other person denied the whole incident. The plaintiff came to Avraham Mintz and presented his case. The defendant went to other rabbinic authorities for support. Rulings began to be written in Italy, some in favor of the plaintiff, others in favor of the defendant. The matter reached Poland, where Yaakov Polak wrote a critique of Mintz's position. A bitter controversy ensued as more than 100 rabbis took the side of Mintz, and an equal number took the sides of Polak. According to the report I heard, eventually the two sides excommunicated one another. It was confirmed by the scholars of Italy that they both died on the same day. Shortly after this incident, another incident occurred that caused Rav Yaakov Polak to abandon Krakow entirely and to live the rest of his life what would seem to be in obscurity. In the year 1522, witnesses testified before the Beis Din, the Jewish court of law in Krakow, that a man had committed adultery with the wife of another man of the community. The husband and wife were ordered to separate. The adulterer, who was the physician to the royal family, prevailed upon the Polish king and queen to punish Rav Yaakov Polak for having embarrassed him with those charges. The king agreed to forgive Rav Yaakov Polak for his crimes of having wrongfully shamed the king's physician on the condition that the Rav would swear to the innocence of the physician and reunite the estranged couple. Having accepted testimony to the contrary, the Rav, of course, had no other choice but to flee Krakow. What happened to him afterwards, and even the exact date of his death, is a matter of speculation amongst historians. For a man of such prestige to end his public life on such a note is very strange. It's important to note that the Talmud explains that every excommunication, as we said before, carries with it a curse. It would seem, if the story told by the Shalshelis HaKabbalah is actually true, that the curse of Avraham Mintz, and perhaps the curse of Yaakov Margolis from 30 years before, truly took effect. After Yaakov Polak departed from Poland, the reins of leadership were taken by his esteemed disciple, Rav Sholem Shachna. And this is how he is described by the Tzemach David. Rav Shachna is on page 16, the great rabbi, the crown of the Jewish people, the most outstanding of his generation, whose reputation spread across the entire world, was from the greatest disciples of Yaakov Polak. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Holy Community of Lublin. From there his soul returned to God in the year 1559, 5319. In his days, Torah was spread throughout Israel, and the Rosh Yeshivas of Poland and Raisan were world-renowned men of immense stature. The Sefer Masas Ben Yomin, written by a disciple of the Ramah, it says, I saw that the great mentor of Shachna, blessed memory, who was an unusually great and outstanding scholar, who was the mentor of all of my mentors, as well as all the greats of this generation. The word Shachna, by the way, as we quote here in paragraph C on page 16, this is taken from the Beis Shmuel and Evan Ezer in terms of writing documents. It says, Shachna, written with a chof, is derived from the word Shechina. And that's why it's Sholem Shachna. Sholem is Hashem's name, is the Shekhinah. Therefore, the Gaon of Shachna, blessed memory, gave for himself the mnemonic, the Shichna Sidrashu. Because you should seek out, you know, Shachna, Shichna. We quote here on page 17, which is unusual. This is written by the son of Rav Shachna, who became the Rosh Hashiva of Lublin after his Petir. That the reason he left us so little, as well as his mentor of Yaakov Polak, was because of extreme humility. They felt any decision that they made would become, you know, because of their authority, become law, and people would not there use their own discretion to disagree with them. And perhaps I'm not right. Listen, as a dayan, in l'dayan al-mashian of royas, I have to make the call, you know, as I see fit. But to make this for all generations, where someone else could come and you know, dispute my ruling, I'll leave it to them. So he never left nothing in print, and even his response that he did not have copied. He just sent it, you know, but it was not perpetuated. And you see on page 17 the high regard that he was held, as is written here, as is in his gravestone. It was truly through Rav Sholem Shachna that Poland became truly a Mokum Torah. We quote here on page 18, and this is an amazing tshuva from Eliezer Bohemia, Rav Yehuda HaChosid, about the status of Torah scholarship in Poland at the end of the 1100s. They instituted for them the donations made on Simchas Torah and the collection on Purim, which went to enhance the Migdash Mat, the miniature temple, the synagogue, which corresponded to the half shekel which was dedicated to the service of the house of our Creator. As they instituted the Machzta Shekel on Purim, in order not to create a burden upon the community, which they could not afford to pay the wages of the Chazonim all at once. As the money that was given for the Machzta Shekel, as you give the half shekel before Purim, well, those monies were collected on Simchas Torah, you know, for the Aliyahs, for the, you know, Atar races, for all this, all went to support the religious functionaries of the community because they could not really afford to give them a regular salary. If it not been for these statutes, a man would never commit himself to take care of all the needs of the community without handsome recompense. They derived this from the ways of our Creator, who instituted 24 gifts on behalf of those who serve in his house, the Kohanim. Now burden them to give it all at one time from the grain or wine. The early generation were wise men who foresaw the future. If you revoke the collection on Purim and the donation of Simchas Torah, donations of the Chasanim, you will cause irreparable damage. Behold, most places in Poland, Russia, and Hungary, because of their pressing poverty, do not have scholars of Torah, and hire any person with expertise that they could find. He serves as their shliach tzibur and teacher. They promise them wages on the basis of these donations. If we revoke them, their wages will not be sufficient to support them. They will descend their high walls and remain without Torah and tefillah, prayer, because they were like, their kolboys. They were the teachers in the community. They were the chazonim in the community. Even if you recant, and this is, he's writing this to Yehuda HaChosid, a tremendous impact on his generation, I'm afraid that your previous words already have made a deleterious effect. Some 200 years later, after Yaakov Polak and Sholem Shachna came to Poland, it became a different country. And just to read you now on page 19, this is taken from the Sefer Yevein HaMetzula, Rimer Nosen Not of Hanover, describing Poland before the massacres of Tach V'Tat, you know, in 1648 and 1649. There, Poland is the pillar of Torah. This is the heading. There is no need to offer proof for something that is common knowledge. There was never so much Torah learning throughout all of the diaspora of Israel as in the land of Poland. Every single community supported a yeshiva. They would give sufficient support to their Rosh Hashiva, so they would be able to conduct the studies without financial worries, so that the study of Torah would be his sole occupation. The Rosh Hashiva would never leave his home throughout the year except to go to and from the Beis Medrash or the Beis HaKnesset, and in this he did not have to collect funds. He would sit there day and night and would only be involved in Torah study. Every community would support Bocharim, older students, and would provide them with a fixed weekly income so they would be able to study with the Rosh Yeshiva. They also give each Bochar at least two boys, younger students, in the Norim, to teach in order to articulate the Gefes, Gemora, Pirish, Tosfos, as Numan. It's an abbreviation. That he studied in order to become accustomed in Pilpul. And as every older student automatically was given to younger students. So everything that he studied, he in turn taught to the younger students. They would give the boys food from the charity fund or from a special food collection. In other words, you had it a lot better if you were a little older. If the community consisted of 50 householders, these are all, this is not Prague. I mean, Krakow had a large community. There's even a small community, 50 balabatim, the 50 householders. They would support at least 30 bukharim and boys. One bukhar with two boys would stay at the home of a householder. At the very least, the bukhar would eat on a regular basis at his table with one of his family. Even though the bukhar had a sufficient stipend from the community, the householder would, as a rule, not charge him for the food and drink that he needed. Some of the generous householders would treat the boys like members of the family and provide all three of them with food and drink throughout the year. And it continues on in page 20. There was almost no home in all of Poland the Torah was not learned. Either the householder was a scholar, or a son or son-in-laws were scholars, or a bukhar was a member of his household. Sometimes all of the above existed in one house. They fulfilled all three things that Rava stated in the second chapter of the Tractate Shabbos. Rava said, he who has a compassion for rabbis will have children that will become rabbis. He who honors rabbis will have sons-in-laws rabbis. He who is in awe of rabbis will himself become a rabbi. This is why there are many scholars in every single community. In a community of 50 householders, there were 20 scholars who had the title Morenu or Chaver. The Rosh Hashiva towered above them, and all of the scholars subservient to him would go to him to study in the yeshiva. It gives you a sense of the kovod ha'Torah, the honor. In every community, the Rosh Hashiva was highly honored. Whether one was rich or poor, his words were followed, and no one dared to oppose him. Figuratively, no one lifted his hand or foot without his permission. What he decreed became law. He had the power to inflict corporal punishment, to fine and publicly shame those who violated the law, and to institute legislation in order to ensure the moral integrity of the community. Despite all of this, they loved the Rosh Hashiva. If one would have had a choice piece of food, such as chicken, he would give half or all of it away to the Rosh Hashiva. They would constantly honor him with other gifts, such as money, silver, gold, specially fed cattle or fowl or fish of superior quality. Also in the synagogue, most of the people purchased mitzvahs would honor the Rosh Hashiva with the mitzvah. The Rosh Hashiva had the chiyuv, the automatic right, to shlishi, the third aliyah on Shabbos, and at least the first day of Yom Tov. If the Rosh Hashiva was a Kohen or Levi, his chiyuv was the aliyah of Kohen or Levi or Acharon, the last aliyah. This was the case even though there were many Kohanim or Leviim in the synagogue. No one left the synagogue on Shabbos or Yom Tov, on page 21, until the Rosh Hashiva first departed, followed by the student body of his yeshiva. Afterwards, the rest of the community would leave and would escort him all the way to his house. At the onset of Yom Tov, everyone would walk over to his house to welcome the approach of the holiday. The great honor afforded the Rosh Hashiva would serve as an incentive for all of the scholars who would constantly devote themselves to study so they too would reach such a level to be appointed a Rosh Hashiva in some community. As the Talmud points out, the observance and study of Torah for an ulterior motive, shloi lishma, will eventually lead to the observance and study for its own sake, lishma. Through this, the whole country became filled with the knowledge of Torah. And even people who are not really scholars. Says, no man left in the morning to his business without hearing words of Torah delivered by a scholar, be Rashi's commentary to the Torah, prophets or holy writings, or Mishnayos or practical halacha. Each one studied according to the desire of his heart. We began the lecture with an analysis of Pilpul. But time doesn't allow really to go through at length the pros and cons. More as we study the pilpul, we discuss the pilpul of the 15th century. Already by the 16th and 17th century, there was a vociferous criticism because of the speculative nature of this. I'd like you, on your own, this is on page 22, we describe what it was like in the yeshiva during in the 17th century. And again, what seemed to be, this was how it was instituted by Shalom Shachna, Yaakov Pollack and Shalom Shachna. It was a very filled schedule. They studied Pilpul, but it was not that much part of a day, as you'll read, as you would think. And the bulk of the day was really studying the facts themselves. But the Rosh Hashiva, it was interesting, would deliver, I was quoting here in Patriot, his chiluk. Is the chiluk already, instead of just the same chiluk as splitting hairs, that was the name of the pilpul of his whole discourse. He would point out contradiction in the Gemara and Rashi's comment, and Tosfos, and answer them, point out the answers themselves contradict each other. Unless he would give an answer here, but the answer here contradicts each other. Then he would give a different answer to the questions, or something similar to that, so the whole entire halacha would be clear. But it would be gag al gabe gag. In other words, he would start this and contradict this, and then start this and contradict that. The session would last at least up until the beginning of the afternoon, you know, with the pilpul, and the first they would learn in the pilpul. In the summer, after the holiday of Shavuos and Rosh Chanuk, up until Pesach, or until Rosh Hashanah in the summer, the Rosh would not spend that much time in delivering chilukim. He would study together with the scholars, the Arba Turim, that's the halacha, with the commentators, With the Bachurim, he would study Rav Alphus or other works. And there's the lower students, he would give one level, and the higher students another. At the very least, they would also study Gemara, Pirush, Rashi, and Tos until the 15th of Av, till the 15th of Shvat. In the beginning, he says they did an Omer a day, and there's one column a day. There are two columns on one folio. So, from then on until Pesach, until Rosh Hashanah, they would just be studying the poskim, halachic authorities. So it was not, they didn't do this the entire time. But as we discussed, that there was much, much resistance. By the time because of the Vilna Gaon, and probably because of his influence, pilpul that was studied up until that came to an end. And the Vilna Gaon really instituted a whole new way of studying. And the approach to this day in the yeshivas is very much based on the type of approach that he took. I would just like to, in conclusion, we have to ask ourselves the question, why did the German and Polish pilpul last so long? The Orchis Tzaddikim criticized in the beginnings in the middle of the 1400s. We know time and time again it was criticized. I believe that, first of all, pilpul served a very important role in attracting students to Torah study. The course of study recommended by the great Torah giants, Maral and the Shiloh, demand tremendous motivation for Torah study for its own sake. It can never attract large numbers of students. At least I think that was the feeling of those who, maybe others felt differently. But the excitement and competition was part and parcel of the pilpul system, which we've quoted others, attracted far more students to the study of Torah. This is especially true as Jews suffered materially and socially and needed an extra stimulus to give them the strength to endure. As we quoted from King David in the beginning of this lecture, Lulei Saroscha Shashuai Ozovati Ba'oni, had not been for your Torah, my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. Even though the students initially covered less ground and often wasted precious time on ridiculous arguments, the excitement kept up their interest and kept them in the Beis HaMedrash. As long as they were studying, there was always the hope they would eventually become motivated to obtain real Torah knowledge. In addition, as you notice from the description of Nosson of Hanover, only part of the time was devoted to pilpul. Considerable time was devoted to the study of the actual Talmudic text as well as the poskim Talmudic authorities. Such an argument finds a parallel in modern times, where Lithuanian yeshivas often spend inordinate time on analysis and relatively little time in gaining broad knowledge. Despite its shortcomings, this method has attracted a whole new generation to Torah study and is responsible for the Torah rebirth in this country and in Israel. By the time of Sholem Shachna died in the year 1559, Poland already become the leading Torah center of all of Europe. Unlike Rav Yaakov Polak and Rav Sholem Shachna, the Torah luminaries of the next generation left us with a great literary legacy. The most outstanding of them was Rav Moshe Israelish, the Ramah, and Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.